Okay, thanks, Kai. Right, so imagine that you're back in 1973 or something like that, and John Bell has just been asked to give a talk about Bell's theorem. The organizers of the conference is going to say, we want you to talk about your 1964 paper. And he says, oh, I'd rather talk about CHSH or things like that, you know, how great Bohmian mechanics is or something like that. The organizers say, no, no, talk about 1964. That's what happened to Matt Pusey yesterday, pretty much, right? So what I want to do today is sort of tell you more or less everything that's happened on this reality of the wave function studies since the PBR theorem. Now, there are two versions of this. I've been giving this talk for probably about 2 years or so now, and it hasn't changed all that much. But there's two versions of this talk I can give. One is the highly optimistic version, which is the version I normally give, which says how great all these fantastic results are. But you can also give, and what I'm going to give today is the pessimistic version. Which the reason I want to give you the pessimistic version is because I guess in my previous talks I haven't been doing a very good job of explaining just how much there is still to do in this area. So I want people to get excited about, oh, well, these results aren't very good so far. We need to have lots and lots more results. So with the comparison that I was making to Bell's theorem, we still are probably somewhere in like 1973 where there haven't been a lot of good experiments done. And we're way away from 2015, where you had loophole-free Bell tests, really fantastic demonstrations of Bell's theorem. When it comes to the reality of the wave function studies, we're still a long way away from that kind of demonstration. Okay, the other thing I want to say is, although I've been giving this talk for about 2 years, it's been a while since I've given it, so if some of my explanations might be a little bit rusty, so I do encourage you to interrupt me anytime you don't understand something, which might be quite a lot. Okay, so because we had the talk from Matt Pusey yesterday, I'm going to run through the first part rather quickly. So first of all, just to establish terminology, when I talk about an ontic state, I mean a state of reality. That means the stuff that's out there independently of us. So if all intelligent life was suddenly wiped out in the universe, it would still have an ontic state. So psiontic is the view that the quantum state is such a thing. And on the other hand, we have an epistemic state, which is supposed to be a state of knowledge or information. And the psi epistemic view is the view that the quantum state is such a thing. Okay, so here's the analogy that we normally make to the situation in classical physics. So if you just consider a single Newtonian particle, then we normally say that its ontic state is a point in phase space, right? So the position and momentum, those are properties that are objectively possessed by the particle. And indeed, any other property that the particle has is just a function of those two. So once you've specified the phase space point, you specified all of the particle's properties. On the other hand, an epistemic state would be something like a probability distribution over phase space. So since my 3D drawing skills aren't that great, I've just drawn something with some contour lines here. But the idea is this is a spread out probability distribution, and it represents our ignorance or uncertainty about what the true phase space point is. Okay. Now, there's a bit of terminological confusion that sometimes happens here. It really doesn't matter that I use the word epistemic here. That's the standard terminology. If we want to have arguments about the interpretation of probability, people will debate whether this is the right term. You could call it, if you're a frequentist, a statistical state. That's all perfectly fine. The distinction that we're trying to make is between things that are intrinsic properties of individual systems and things that are not, right? So even if you're a frequentist, you say, I need to specify an ensemble or something like that. Okay, so the idea is the quantum state something more like this or something more like this? That's the question. Here are some quotes from some of the founders of quantum theory. All I want to say here is that this is a rare issue on which Einstein and Bohr were in total agreement. or more or less. They're both on the epistemic side, right? So Bohr is saying that physics concerns what we can say about nature. There is some subtle issue as to whether he really meant say here, right? So did he have some kind of linguistic view of the quantum state, perhaps? But from the point of view of the distinctions I'm trying to make here, it's like not an intrinsic property of the system, right? That's the key thing. Einstein obviously famously had the ensemble view of quantum states. So he's taking maybe a frequentist view of probability, but still that's on the psi epistemic side as far as I'm concerned. So here's a table. This table has been taken way too seriously by people like Adán Cabello, and they've written whole papers just about this table. I don't exactly know why. As far as I'm concerned, it's useful to classify interpretations of quantum theory, but it's probably only useful to classify them relative to a specific particular question that you have in mind. Because I have seen papers where people have made all sorts of very fine-grained distinctions between interpretations, and if you really try to classify them, you end up with a sort of very complicated map. And on any classification you make, there are some interpretations that don't fit in. But the point I'm trying to make here is just we can classify interpretations by their view of the quantum state. We can also classify them on more what has been sort of historically more important lines as to whether they're anti-realist or realist. I don't really care also what terminology you use here. I'm just trying to get at the distinction between things which are a bit Copenhagen-like, don't admit objective states of reality independent of the observer, and things which aren't, so things which do admit such things. Okay, so up here you have all of the Copenhagen-ish type approaches, including things like cubism. Almost all realist interpretations of quantum theory that you have ever heard of are in this box. So they almost all take the quantum state to be something physically real, you know, in some cases like something akin to some sort of physical field. And then you have the possibility of this box. Okay, so here you're a realist, you want there to be underlying states of reality, but you just don't want the quantum state to be part of that. You want the quantum state to represent knowledge within that. Obviously, this is a view of Rob Speckens, arguably Einstein. Ballantyne's statistical interpretation is at least compatible with this in that he admits the possibility of hidden variables. This is all just a list of names at the moment, though, because there aren't any well-worked-out interpretations like this. And the question is, why? Is there anything possible here? Up here you have nothing because this is a contradiction, right? So you can't believe that there's no reality and also believe that the quantum state is part of that reality that doesn't exist.
Where
am I? I would probably put myself in this box, but if pushed by future work into believing that this is a contradiction, I'll have to go somewhere else.
Where would you go?
Well, these boxes, both of these boxes are nearby, right? So the potential pushing me both ways is roughly equal. And
not the upper right box?
On some days I want to be like this, and on some days I want to be over there. But let's hope that it doesn't come to that. Okay, so let me just briefly review why you would want quantum states to be epistemic. Let me just say that if Rob Speckens wrote his beautiful paper about his toy theory in 2007, and if you haven't read that, you need to read that, because if you don't read that, you don't understand this issue, basically. What I'm going to do here is concentrate on just one of the things that it's supposed to explain, but please bear in mind that there's a whole range of quantum phenomena that it's supposed to explain, and this is just one small subset of that. So the idea is, if we go back to our classical phase space picture, where now I've collapsed phase space down to one line so I can draw a couple of probability distributions. One of the things that distinguishes the phase space points from probability distributions is that probability distributions can overlap with one another. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, one of the things it means is that if somebody prepares a classical system with this probability distribution or with that probability distribution and doesn't tell you which, then there's no way that you can tell with certainty. Why? Because when they do that, there's going to be some sort of finite probability of ending up in this overlap region. And when you're there, there's just nothing that exists in reality that could tell you with certainty, right? So there's some probability that it came from here and some probability that it came from there. So the idea is that if quantum states are more like this than like this, then we can have a similar kind of explanation for the indistinguishability of quantum states, okay? So the fact that two non-orthogonal pure states can't be perfectly distinguished, you could attempt to explain by the fact that when I prepare either this or this, actually sometimes the thing that exists in reality, the state of the system, the true physical state of the system, is sometimes the same. Okay, so if my measurement device comes and sees that thing that's the same, there's no way it could tell with certainty. Okay, so that is the psi epistemic explanation of indistinguishability. And there are lots of other things you can explain with overlap, like the no cloning theorem and things like that, but we're going to focus on this particular one. Okay, so if we're going to discuss this, we need a framework, mathematical framework to do it in. This is the ontological models framework, which Matt, again, also spoke about yesterday. So I'm only going to consider a very simple kind of experiment where you have a preparation. So the system with a finite dimensional Hilbert space is prepared in some quantum state, and then immediately afterwards is measured in some orthonormal basis. And then quantum theory tells us that the probabilities will be given by the Born rule. Okay, so this is the operational description, but we don't believe necessarily that this is a description of what's going on in reality. So the job now is to try and account for these probabilities in terms of the system having some real physical properties. So just following Bell, we tend to call those real physical properties lambda. They're called ontic states, states of reality. And the idea is that this correlation between the preparation and the measurement should be due to the fact that the system actually had some physical properties. Okay, so what we don't want to assume in this framework is anything like determinism. We're not interested in the issue of determinism. We're interested in the issue of the reality of the quantum state, right? So we want to make sort of very permissive assumptions. So in particular, when we pick our quantum state here, we don't want to assume that this preparation device has full control over lambda. So it's actually going to prepare some spread out probability distribution over lambda, representing our uncertainty about lambda when we do a certain preparation. And the measurement here, we're not going to assume that that's deterministically, that we're not going to assume that that's determined by lambda, that the outcome is determined uniquely by lambda either. So for each value of lambda, here I've done the case of a two outcome measurement, we're going to have this set of response functions, they're just conditional probabilities. So for each value of lambda, there's going to be a probability of getting one of the two outcomes, and those probabilities have to sum to one. Okay. Now here, I'm allowing these functions to explicitly depend on the choice of measurement basis because I want to allow for theories that are contextual. Okay. So we don't want to get blocked by the Cochen-Specker theorem and say we can't have any of these theories. Okay, so then what does this theory say about what the probabilities are? It says you take these conditional probabilities given lambda. Actually, we don't know lambda exactly, so we have to average them over our uncertainty about lambda, and that gives you the probability that you'll observe in the experiment. And if this theory is going to be empirically adequate, it needs to reproduce the predictions of quantum theory. Okay, so since this is important, let me just go over that. Now I'm going to go over that in language that mathematicians will prefer, but I'm saying the same thing, right? So ontological model for a finite dimensional Hilbert space, we need a measurable space. So lambda is our set of ontic states, the properties of reality. If we're going to assign probabilities to it, it needs to be a measurable space. So here's our sigma algebra of measurable subspace subsets. By the way, if you don't care about measure theory, you can think about this all in terms of probability distributions and physicist rigor if you like, but it actually turns out to be a bit easier to do things this way. So each state in the Hilbert space is going to correspond to some probability measure. So it's something that assigns measurable subsets a probability between 0 and 1. Each of the orthonormal basis is going to correspond to a set of conditional probability functions. So we normally like to think of these as functions of lambda, okay? But for each measurement basis and outcome, there's going to be such a function. And those probabilities have to sum to 1 over the outcomes of the measurement. And then you require that this reproduces the quantum predictions when you average these. Okay, so that's the basic setup. Are there any questions about that before we go on? Well, that's straightforward. Okay, good. Because at the bottom line, that's all I want to assume. Okay, that's all I want to assume about the model of reality. Okay, so now we can make this distinction. So we have 2 quantum states. We say they're ontologically distinct. Well, the formal mathematical definition is that there has to exist a set that's measure 1 according to one of them and measure 0 according to the other one. But in pictures, what it means is this. So if these are probability distributions that represent those probability measures, then if you have this condition holding, then they won't overlap, right? So here's an example of a set that's measure 1 according to this guy and measure 0 according to that guy. Whereas if you have overlap in the probability distributions, then you can't find such a set. Okay, so this is the case of ontological distinctness. This is ontological indistinctness. And of course, we're going to need this if we're going to exploit that psi epistemic explanation of indistinguishability. So we say that a model is psiontic if every pair of states is like this, so ontologically distinct. Otherwise, it's called psi epistemic. But the thing I want to draw attention to is that this is a very, very weak definition of what it means to be psi epistemic. So it says nothing about how large the overlaps have to be. And of course, if you have 2 quantum states which have a very large inner product, they're almost indistinguishable from one another. If their probability distributions have a very, very tiny overlap, but non-zero, that's not going to be enough to exploit the psi epistemic explanation of indistinguishability. Okay? So this is a very sort of permissive definition. The reason why it was used is that the first sets of psi ontology theorems were able to prove this. So you didn't care about how weak this condition was because you were able to prove that. But we're going to be interested in stronger notions of psi epistemicity. Okay, so now just briefly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. We know that in the literature, there's a bunch of theorems which attempt to show that all models must be psiontic. Pusey-Barrett-Rudolph theorem you heard about yesterday. And here he is, the man himself. That was good timing. There are others. These are the 2 that I think have any merit to them at all. There's a lot of these things in the literature. These 2 are relatively interesting. And I wrote about them in great detail in a review article from 2014. So if you really want to read about these things in huge, excruciating detail, then you can have a look at that article. All I want to say about them right now is that every single one of these theorems makes assumptions in addition to the bare ontological models framework that I outlined. Okay, so there are 2 things we can do. We can like sit around and try and have a debate about those assumptions, or we can say, well, let's see what we can prove without any extra assumptions. Okay, so I'm going to do the latter here, and I think that it's worthwhile doing because if we, first of all, you know, from a foundational point of view, we want to know what we can do with fewer assumptions. But if you suspect that sometime in the distant future these kinds of results might have actual applications, then the fewer assumptions you make about them, the better that's going to be. But maybe we'll talk about that a bit in later. Okay, so if you don't make any assumptions, you have psi epistemic models. So that seems to be, that seems like that might be the end of the story. So for a qubit, there's this Cochin-Speckle model. I don't need to go into the details, but the point of the story is just that when you have non-orthogonal states, you have overlapping probability measures. Okay, so you think, well, maybe a qubit is quite special. What happens if I go to higher dimensional systems? And in higher dimensional systems, you also have psi epistemic theories. That was first proved by Peter Lewis and collaborators, most of whom were also on the PBR paper. So John Barrett, Terry Rudolph, maybe some other people were on that. Subsequently, Scott Aronson and collaborators again proved that you could have a model in which every pair of non-orthogonal states has overlap. However, these models aren't great because if you take a pair of quantum states which has some fixed inner product and look at what happens as you embed that in an increasingly larger and larger dimensional Hilbert space, then you find that the amount of overlap goes down. Okay. So, and it goes down, you know, it's going to, when you get to infinite dimensions, it's going to be zero. But in any case, you're going to hit some dimension at some point at which you don't really have enough overlap to explain any of the indistinguishability of the quantum states. Okay, so the question is, does that have to happen? Because if that has to happen, then although you can have psi epistemic theories, you might as well forget about them because they're not going to be able to do any of the explanatory work of explaining the indistinguishability, especially if we believe that the world is made out of a lot of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So this is the topic, this is the main topic of the talk. I want to talk a bit about overlap bounds. So in order to address this question, we need to have a measure of the amount of overlap of the classical probability distributions and of the corresponding quantum states. And there's several different ways you can do this. They all give you slightly a little bit different stories. I'm just going to take one measure here. And the reason why I'm choosing this particular measure is because it's one that happens to be experimentally robust and has been used in experiments to test this stuff. Okay, so the idea is, let me just look at the cartoon picture first. If you have two probability distributions like this, then you just take the joint area under both of the graphs. That's your measure of overlap. Okay, so formally, in measure theory, you define it like this. You try to partition the space into two sets, and you try to make it such that mu psi assigns a small probability to this part of the space, and the complement, mu phi, should assign a small, as small as possible. So this is what's going on here. You choose these two sets. So there's a part of the space on which mu psi has no support at all, so I'm going to put that in omega. And the part on which mu phi has no support, I'm going to put that in the complement set. But then there's this overlap region, and what I'm going to do in the overlap region is I'm going to say, okay, which of these two probability distributions is smaller? Then I'm going to put it in the corresponding set. Okay, so that's how this optimization corresponds to this. This measure is 1 minus the classical variational distance, if you know about that, the classical analog of the trace distance. So it turns out to be related to the optimal, it has an operational interpretation, which is as follows. So suppose somebody either prepares this state or that state with 50-50 probability, so you don't know which. And then, by some magic process, which we don't know how possibly could happen, but by some magic process, you learn the exact value of lambda. So you're told this is the exact ontic state. So bear in mind that usually, when you're doing quantum experiments, you don't have access to that, right? But suppose somehow you did, then to distinguish these two based on this, this would be your optimal probability of success. And so that's sort of just linearly related to this overlap measure. Okay, so we want to compare that to the corresponding quantum notion. So here, we basically do the same thing, except we, instead of basing it on knowing the ontic state, we have to base it on doing a quantum measurement. So we look at all two outcome quantum measurements, and we try to find a measurement for which this state assigns a low probability to one of the outcomes, and this one assigns a low probability to the other outcome. And that's the same kind of quantity. And this is 1 minus the quantum trace distance. Quantum trace distance for pure states, you can do this optimization, it's this quantity. So we get this funny 1 minus the square root of 1 minus type of construction. Okay, but you can do that explicitly and just compute it. And this has the same interpretation. So your optimal probability of success of distinguishing the two states based on doing a quantum measurement is this. Okay. So in order for the psi epistemic explanation of indistinguishability to work, what you would like is that these two quantities should be similar. Okay. So I'm not necessarily going to demand that you need to explain all of the indistinguishability of quantum states in terms of overlap. But if overlap is going to play any role at all, then you certainly don't want to have a situation in which this thing is large and this thing is very small. Okay. So the question is, can we prove that? That has to happen. Okay, so there's been a lot of bounds on this sort of stuff in the literature. So now what I want to do is just sort of give you an overview of what's the state of the art on those. So it's very hard to just pick two states and get a bound just for those two particular states. So what we normally do is we take some set V of quantum states, so some set of pure states, and then we pick another state which we're going to compare them all with, and then we take the average of the overlaps between psi and all of the quantum states in this set. Okay, so we try to get a bound on this average. Now, of course, if this average is some particular value, then that means that there's one, at least one pair of states in that set that has an overlap less than that, right? Because it's an average. And then we can just sort of compute, or that sometimes, in some cases, we have to get bounds, but sort of typically we know what the set of states is, so we can just compute these. And then almost all papers on this subject then report as the figure of merit this thing, so the ratio of the quantum of the classical overlap to the quantum overlap. And then we have lots of dramatic results which show that this thing has to go to zero as we increase the number of states that we're talking about here. So it seems like, great, that's it. But that's not really it, because this thing can go to zero if this thing goes to zero, provided this thing goes to zero faster, right? So you can have a situation in which you're considering families of sets of states and increasing Hilbert space dimension. As you increase the Hilbert space dimension, the inner product between the states is getting smaller and smaller, so they're getting almost completely distinguishable. And it's just that the classical measure is getting more distinguishable much faster. Okay, but sort of if this kind of result is only true for states that are almost distinguishable anyway, sort of who cares, right? What you really like to show is that there's some pair of states that has a fairly large overlap such that the classical measures have a low overlap. But if you have that, you've really like made these this psi epistemic explanation of distinguishability look implausible for almost all of quantum mechanics. Why do I say that? Because if it's true for states with a fairly large overlap, you can fairly plausibly argue that it should also be true for states with smaller quantum indistinguishability, because it's a fairly reasonable requirement of ontological models that dynamics should not decrease the amount of overlap. Right? You expect if you do some dynamics to the system that it can only decrease the amount of distinguishability. So if you've proven it for something that's sort of has a very large inner product, then you've essentially proven it for almost everything. So that's what you really want to do. So the best thing to do is to not look at this ratio, but the very best thing to do is to just look at these two things individually and see how they compare and see whether you can get that kind of effect that I'm talking about. But as a sort of proxy for that, it's quite reasonable to look at trying to optimize this overlap deficit, right? So this thing can vary between 1 and 0. And if it's close to 1, then you really know that there are states with large inner product that have low classical overlap. Okay, so the aim, in my view, should be let's try to get this figure of merit as close to 1 as possible. So let's see what happens with the proofs that are in the literature. So I'm going to explain a bit about where these things come from in a minute. This is a fairly complicated slide. It's just to say that there's been a bunch of results in the literature. These three here are based on a common proof technique, at least with the particular analysis I'm giving here. And this proof technique is based on contextuality inequalities of a type similar to the UO contextuality inequality. I'm going to explain what that is in a bit. This one here is wasn't done as a proof of the reality of the wave function. It's just another contextuality inequality, but one which I found out about at a meeting this summer. And it turns out that this one is going to give us the best bound that we know so far. So this is all, it's kind of, there's lots of D's and N's floating around. So what I'm going to do is just show you what happens to this when you try to optimize this. So try to choose the parameters which optimize the overlap deficit. This is what happens. So in the first one that was published, it turns out, so what typically happens is if you're trying to optimize this, this difference, it starts going up as you increase the number of states and dimension, and then it goes down again. So there's going to be some optimal dimension and optimal number of states for each of these proofs. So in the original one, it turns out that it's quite good. And like if you're thinking about doing experimental tests of this, you want relatively low dimension and low numbers of states. That's quite good. To get the optimal here, you only need 2 qubits, 4-dimensional Hilbert space. You need to prepare 16 states, and then you get this overlap deficit. The one that I proposed, which looked really good in terms of the ratio, is actually quite crap when you optimize the difference. It's worse than this one. And then there are two ones here where we only really get good results in the asymptotic limit. Okay, so in Cyril Branchiard's proof, his proof works a bit differently. As you increase the number of states in his proof, you can actually keep the Hilbert space dimension fixed. So it's a certain number of states which exist in each Hilbert space dimension. So you can do the whole thing just in Hilbert space dimension 4. And then if you take the number of states to infinity, you get this overlap deficit, which, however, you don't get anywhere near for sets of states that are sort of the order of a few dozen, right? So if you want to keep sort of order 10 states, which is reasonable for an experiment, then you're not going to get anywhere near here, and you're actually going to do much better if you did this experiment. And then this one, this thing is based on sort of an existence proof, so I can't even tell you what the states are here, but there's an existence proof for this. And all I know is that if you take the number of states to infinity, and the best bound I have on the dimension there is that that also goes to infinity. It might not, but that's the best we can do at bounding it. Then you'll get this result, which is the best so far. But that's obviously not very experimentally viable, but as a theoretical bound, that's the best one that I know of. There are a few other constructions that people have told me about, but they always do. All the ones I've heard of do worse than this. Okay. So that's the situation. So then you may have heard that there was an experiment done on this. This was done in Andrew White's group in Queensland. What they did was they tested this Cyril Branchiard result here. And in those days, everybody was thinking about ratios. So ratios, this looks pretty good because everything's everything can be done with 2 qubits, and you can get a ratio of 0. So what they found in that experiment is that in terms of the ratio, they only managed to get this, so they didn't get anywhere near to 0. And in terms of this overlap deficit, it's 0.047, which, since they only used 2 qubits, is actually quite close to what you expect to get from the Cyril Branchiard result for the number of states they used. However, I think that you could just easily do an experiment where you get a larger delta L, since you get close to the theoretical bound, if you just did this one, which only involves preparing and measuring some mutually unbiased basis states, it's not that hard, you would easily beat this bound. So anybody who's got a quantum experiment they want to do a quantum system, 2 qubits they want to do a quick experiment with, you can beat that very easily, I think. OK. So are there any questions about that sort of overview? The point I want to make here, of course, is that when you start looking at these overlap deficits, these results, which seemed really great before, they're all not that great, right? How can we get, we need to get this overlap deficit much closer to 1. So there's a lot to do in order to do that. Okay, so in the last part of the talk, I would like to explain where these bounds come from a little bit. And it's sort of quite interesting because these three here were originally proved by a technique. Actually, I shouldn't say for this one because, but anyway. At least these two were originally proved by a technique which seemed to have nothing to do with Cauchy-Speicher theorem or contextuality and inequalities. It was like sort of seemed a bit sort of pulled out of thin air. It turns out that if you look at those results, you can say, actually, these are based on contextuality inequalities. And then you can think, well, what contextuality inequalities are they? And some of them are ones that are known, and some of them are ones that we didn't know about before. So it gives you a new proof technique for contextuality inequalities as well. So I'd like to show you where these bounds come from and explain that as well. Right. So first of all, let me remind you what we mean by Cauchy-Speicher non-contextual model. So we have these response functions in an ontological model, and if we impose two conditions on them, first is that we should have outcome determinism. That means that if you know lambda, then you know exactly what measurement outcomes are going to happen. Right? So all these probabilities have to be 0 or 1. And then there's a condition called measurement non-contextuality, which in this case means that if you have two bases in your Hilbert space, and you have a basis vector that's common to both of them, then it should have the same probabilities regardless of which basis you're in. Okay, so that's the normal Cauchy-Speicher notion of non-contextuality. Now what I'm going to do is measure theoretize it. A little bit. So let's pretend we're just in an arbitrary ontological model now. It's not necessarily non-contextual. Then for each basis and measurement outcome of that basis, I can consider the set of ontic states that give probability 1 to that particular measurement outcome when you measure it in that basis. Okay. So that is a well-defined measurable set because this is a measurable function. It might be empty, of course, if you're in a fundamentally non-deterministic theory, but it exists. Then what we can do is we can take the set of all bases that contain the vector A and just take the intersection of all these sets. So this is going to be the set of ontic states that assigns probability 1 to the outcome A, regardless of how you measure it. Whether I measure it in this basis or that basis, I still get the outcome 1. Okay, so this is, in some sense, the set of ontic states that give outcome 1 to this guy non-contextually. What did I want to say about this? I can't remember. Anyway. Okay, so then you can prove a theorem that basically says that if there's a Cauchy-Speicher non-contextual model in this sense, if and only if there exists a model where the probabilities come from just integrating over these sets. Okay, so basically, if the measure of this non-contextual set is equal to the probability of getting that outcome, then that's basically the same thing as Cauchy-Speicher non-contextuality. It's not quite the same thing because if you satisfy this, you can have crazy contextual behavior on sets of measure 0. But this is the only implication of Cauchy-Speicher non-contextuality that's at all relevant for the experimental probabilities you can observe. So I think this is the correct measure theoretic definition of Cauchy-Speicher non-contextuality. And anyway, all the inequalities we test only ever test this. Okay, so by the way, I'm always assuming that we're only considering a finite set of orthonormal bases, just so that this is going to be a properly defined measurable set. So suppose we have some finite set of states, which may be the set of all the states that appear in our measurement bases. We find that in a model that satisfies this, there's an inequality, like this. Okay, so if you have some bound like this, then that's what we mean by a non-contextuality inequality. Okay, so now I want to show you that anytime you have one of these, you have an overlap bound. Okay, so we need a couple of things. So first of all, if we take this set of states V, then if it's got a finite number of states in it, then we can always construct a covering set of bases, by which I mean that so these sets of states here may not be organized into orthonormal bases, or they may not include full orthonormal bases. But what I mean is that if I have a pair of states that's orthogonal in this set of states, then I can construct an orthonormal basis that includes those two states. Okay? So by a covering set of bases, I mean for every pair of states in this set that are orthogonal, there's some basis in this set, which includes both of them. OK, so then you look in your ontological model, and you see, well, this has got to reproduce the quantum probabilities. So if I prepare A and then measure A, then I have to get probability 1. So that means that this probability, when we integrate over the epistemic state corresponding to A, and we integrate its response function over that, we have to get probability 1. Now, since these things are probabilities, they're less than or equal to 1 everywhere. And this is a probability measure, so it has total measure 1. So in order for this thing to be 1, it means that the set on which this guy is equal to 1 has to be a measure 1 set according to this guy. Okay. Right, that's true for every basis that includes A. So if we take the intersection of all those bases, then we're looking at this set that assigns it probability 1 non-contextually. It's a finite intersection of measure 1 sets. That's also going to be measure 1. Okay, it's just intersection of a finite number of measure 1 sets is also measure 1. Okay, so now we can use that to get a bound on these classical overlaps. So remember, the classical overlap is an infimum over all partitions into two sets, like this. So if I get rid of the infimum and just pick a set, then that's going to be an upper bound on this. Okay, so the set I'm going to pick when I'm comparing psi with A, I'm just going to pick gamma A, so this non-contextual set. That's going to be an upper bound. Okay, so we just showed on the previous slide that mu A has to assign probability 1 to gamma A. So therefore, if we take the complement set, which we have here, that must be measure 0. And hence, this classical overlap is bounded by the amount of probability that mu psi assigns to this non-contextual set of states. Okay. Okay, but then if we have one of these non-contextuality inequalities, which we derived previously for non-contextuality, that means automatically it's going to also be an upper bound on these classical overlaps. Okay, so that's why any non-contextuality inequality gives you an overlap bound. Okay, so one thing you can do, which is the first thing that I tried to do, is to just say, okay, let's look up some contextuality inequalities. There's a whole construction which some of you will know about in terms of graph theory by Cabello, Severini, and Winter, which establishes a connection between contextuality inequalities and properties of the orthogonality graph. So the graph where you take as your vertices the states that you have in your set, and you draw an edge between them if they're orthogonal. And there are some graph properties. We don't need to go into the details of that. But then you're going to get a bound on the average of these classical overlaps. And I shouldn't have said that. This is an old version of the slide. But this is where I originally derived my result from. And this is what I'm doing with that Amaral et al. Result, which actually gives the best bound so far. There's sort of been, in my mind at least, there's been a little competition between the two proof methods, either doing it by Cabello, Severini, or Winter, or this other technique, which I'm about to explain. And for the longest time, the other technique, which I'm about to explain, was winning, right? But it turns out that the best result we know of does actually come from this at the moment. Okay, so let me now explain this other technique, which wasn't originally derived from contextuality, but I'm going to derive for you contextuality inequalities, a different type of contextuality inequalities, which will give you a different type of bound. And these are based on anti-distinguishability, which again, Matt Pusey mentioned yesterday. So this is the way these work. Also, if you remember, anti-distinguishability was important for the Pusey-Barrett-Rudolph theorem. Here I'm using this in a different context, but all this stuff is very closely related to contextuality inequalities. Okay, so first of all, a definition. So let's just take a bunch of pure states. Okay, on this slide, I said there had to be D of them in D dimensions. I will want to generalize that slightly, but let's just do it this way. So we have a set of states. These states aren't necessarily orthogonal. In fact, typically, they're not going to be orthogonal. It's just some set of states. But I'm going to call them anti-distinguishable if there exists an orthonormal basis, so some other set of states, which, again, there are D of them, and such that if I pick a state from this set and the corresponding state from this basis, those are going to be orthogonal. Okay, so let me give you an example. Here's a set of three states in a real three-dimensional Hilbert space. I'm neglecting normalization factors here. These aren't orthogonal to one another, but this state is orthogonal to this one, this one's orthogonal to this one, and this one's orthogonal to this one. And these three states here do form a basis. Okay, so these are all pairwise orthogonal. So that's like a simple example of an anti-distinguishable set. Is that clear? Okay, so what that means is if I prepare one of these three states and then I perform this measurement, then whichever outcome I get, I rule out at least one of the three states from having been prepared. Now, you can generalize this a little bit, which you do need to do for the contextuality inequalities. It doesn't matter that there are exactly D of these. If there are less than D of these, then these states have to be in the subspace that's spanned by this guy. Okay, then you get the same kind of results. Okay, so how do you use this to prove contextuality inequalities? Well, the basic observation is that if I take the intersection of the non-contextual states that are non-contextual for all of the states in this set, then their intersection has to be zero. So in this case, if I took the set of states that were non-contextual for each of these outcomes, then there would be nothing in that set. Why is that true? Because an ontic state has to assign a probability. So an ontic state has to assign a probability for every possible measurement. Okay, if I prepare a system in one of these three states, then as I proved before, if I prepare it in this state, it has to assign probability 1 to this outcome. So that means that the ontic state is going to be in gamma A1 for that one. But if it's in the joint intersection if there's three-way overlap between these states, then that's going to be true for all of them. It has to assign probability 1 to each of these three if it's in these three states. But that means that in order to reproduce the predictions of this measurement, that would mean it has to assign probability 0 to this guy, probability 0 to that guy, and probability 0 to that guy. That just contradicts the fact that you've got to get at least one outcome. Okay? So there can't be any states in the non-contextual set for each of these three guys. Yeah.
This gamma, is it the set of states you can get when you prepare that, or is it?
No. Sorry. I think I confused this a little bit, right? These are the I'm doing this as a non-contextuality inequality, so it hasn't got to do with what states are in the support of the probability distribution. These are just the sets that non-contextually assign that outcome.
And I don't follow
that. Okay. Okay, yeah. So I got the argument slightly wrong. I told you at the beginning, you weren't here, that it's been a while since I gave this talk, so I'm going to get some explanations wrong. So let me do that again. Right, so this is orthogonal to this. This means that there exists an orthonormal basis in which includes these two states as well as some third state. Okay, so if I'm in the non-contextual set for this guy, I must assign probability zero for that guy.
For that measure.
For that, in that particular measurement. But we're looking at the set of states which assign probabilities non-contextually for measurements. That's the definition of these gammas, right? Let me go back. So these gammas are defined as the intersection for all possible measurements of all possible measurements containing A, the intersection of this of the probability one. Thanks. Right. So they're the set of states which assign the outcome A with certainty, regardless of how you measure it. So they're kind of like the non-contextual. They're the non-contextual states for that particular measurement outcome, right? Another question.
Yeah, so you're also assuming this is measurement independence here, that any state is compatible with any set of measurements?
We're assuming measurement, we're assuming all of the sort of standard things for no-go theorems, yeah, so lambda is independent of measurement settings. That's part of the ontological model spring. Okay, right, so now, if such a state assigns probability 1 to this guy, if it's in gamma A1, then it assigns probability 1 in any measurement includes this guy. So it must assign this guy probability 0. If it's also in this guy, it assigns this one probability 0. And if it's also in this guy, it assigns this one probability 0. But since these are non-contextual, then if I make this measurement, it still assigns probability 0.
Why does the assignments to the states on the right, why isn't that allowed to depend on the consequence?
Because if it assigns probability 1 to this, then it has to assign probability 0 to that.
Like, my kind of is zero in the measurement that includes A3 and A3 pair, but then non-zero in the A1 pair, A2 pair, A3 pair measurement.
There is a reason, I've forgotten it.
Isn't that
the contextual values? No, but it's only not, so I'm looking at things that are non-contextual for particular states. So, okay, we have to talk about this. I've forgotten the reason, but I think there is a reason. Yeah, okay. But let's just leave that aside. I know this issue can be dealt with because I've thought about it, but as I said, it's been a while since I talked about this. It may just be that we can take intersect this whole thing with the union of the non-contextual states for those guys too. So it may not make a difference to the proof if you do that. I can't remember the details. So we just assume that we can sort that out and move on. Okay, right. So we now know that these sort of D-way intersections would all have to be empty. So then what we do is we are going to use measure theoretic inequality. But this is something that should be familiar to most of you. This is just the inclusion-exclusion principle. So if I take the union of a bunch of sets, then I can break down that probability into the sum of the probabilities in each of those sets. But then I've counted the intersections of the sets too many times, so I've got to subtract them off. But when I do that, I've subtracted off the triple way intersections too many times, so I've got to add them back on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's a result called the Bonferroni inequality, which says if you terminate this sequence at any point, you get an alternating sequence of upper and lower bounds. Okay, so what we're going to do is just terminate it here, and we'll use this second Bonferroni inequality. So then what I'm going to do for my xj's is I'm going to take the non-contextual states for some set psi, for some state psi, and I'm going to intersect them with the non-contextual sets for each of my states aj that in the set that I'm comparing it to. Okay, we know that if I use the probability measure corresponding to psi, then this set will be assigned probability 1. So we know that's a measure 1. And then what we do is you just insert these intersections into this inequality. So the first thing I'm going to do is like make a very weak bound on this. This is a probability, so it's upper bounded by 1. So that's this. And then on this side, I've just got mu psi of this thing. But this part is a measure 1 set, so I'm just going to get the measure of the AJs, gamma AJs. And then for this one, I have these triple Y's intersections, okay? Because both XJ and XK contain a factor of gamma psi. That's going to be intersection of that with itself is just itself, right? So I'm just going to get these three-way intersections. Okay, so now, this is the inequality I have. So now, suppose it's the case that for every J and K, these three states are anti-distinguishable for all J not equal to K. Then, if they're anti-distinguishable, we prove that their intersection has to be empty, right? So this would have measure zero. So in that case, you will get this kind of contextuality inequality where the sum of all the probabilities of the states in your set is bounded by 1. Okay, so an example of this construction is the UO inequality. So here I'm going to take my psi to be this state, and then I'm going to take all of these as my states that I'm comparing them to. So if I take any triple of psi and two of these, they're anti-distinguishable. One of those is easy to see because right now this is my psi, and these are two of the other states in the UA set. And I showed you those were anti-distinguishable before. But the same is true because it's just sort of permutations of where the signs, minus signs are. The same is going to be true for any triple. Some reason I've left a transpose here and not on the other ones, but okay. Right, so any triple of this guy and two of these is going to be anti-distinguishable for exactly the same reason. And that is what's called the UO inequality. So in the paper, they prove it using a graph with 13 rays in. It turns out that if you take these states I've got here and add all of the bases you need to anti-distinguish these, you get that 13-ray graph. Now you can actually just see why it's true without even having to construct that. So here's a generalization, simple generalization. Now just to take the d-dimensional generalization of this, right? So I'm going to take this to be my psi, and then I'm just going to take all possible vectors with plus or minus ones in them, right? So we take all possible binary strings, and we construct the vectors which have plus or minus ones in every component. Then every triple is anti-distinguishable for very, very similar, same sort of reasons. And so the sum of the probabilities to all of these guys must be bounded by 1. Okay. Now, if you take the same set of states, so now this was from anti-distinguishability properties. If you take the same set of states and look at its orthogonality graph instead, and apply the Cabello-Severini-Winter construction, you get this bound, which is also a non-contextuality inequality, but a much larger bound, right? So sometimes take the same set of states, look at their anti-distinguishability properties rather than their distinguishability properties. Sometimes you get much better bounds. Now, it's sort of a bit of a lie because this construction, you know, really, if you're testing it, you have to do all of those anti-distinguishing measurements. So there are actually far more vectors in this set when you expand it to include all of those. And then you can view it as a CSW type of inequality if you do the generalization where you allow vertices to have weights on them. because all the anti-distinguishing vectors have weight zero, then you'll get this kind of inequality. So in some sense, it's the same type of inequality, but the emphasis is a bit different. We're looking at anti-distinguishability properties, and it's much easier to find sets of states that are anti-distinguishable than distinguishable. Right? There are conditions known in the literature without having to construct the measurements explicitly. There are conditions for when are three states anti-distinguishable, so you can actually do this kind of analysis quite easily. And there are other sets of states that you can do this with, like mutually unbiased bases and things like that. Okay, so I've basically run out of time. So first part of the talk summary. So several bounds exist showing that the ratio of classical to quantum overlaps goes to zero. It's much, much harder to get this overlap deficit close to one, and the best we know so far is about 0.3. So it's still unknown whether models for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces have to be psiontic or not. It could be they just have to have zero overlap, any ontological model, right? So it could be that a bound where this is equal to one is possible, right? We don't know, right? But there's some gap in our knowledge between this and showing that this is equal to one. Modulo the issue that Matt brought up, these methods that have been developed to bound the overlaps actually yield you new contextuality inequalities, or some of them are new. But sometimes, just looking at the same sets, anti-distinguishability versus distinguishability, sometimes you get better bounds than you knew before. There's a bunch of open questions. I won't go through those in great detail. Let me just skip to the conclusion. So suppose that we do, sometime in the future, get this delta L all the way to very close to 1. What would you do then if you still want to be a psi epistemicist, if you still want to have these nice explanations for indistinguishability and things like that? You always have the option of adopting something neo-Copenhagen. The merits of that move are the same here as they are as a response to Bell's theorem or anything like that. If you want to still be a realist, then you have to go outside the ontological models framework. And as Steve mentioned, violating measurement independence is one way of doing that, which you might call retrocausality. I can see a pained look on your face when I said that. But that's one way of doing it. There are all sorts of other options that people talk about. I personally think that probably something involving this is going to be the answer. But these are sort of open possibilities. So I want to just end by saying, well, what's the principle behind still being a psi epistemicist? And I think sort of Rob was expressing something similar to this. So if you have a whole bunch of quantum phenomena and you have a model for them that has very, very natural explanation, then you find, oh, I can't extend that explanation to the whole of quantum theory. So what should you do? Should you say, I'm going to throw out all of those explanations, and I'm going to adopt something where those phenomena which seemed quite simple are suddenly going to be totally crazy. Suddenly things which I had a local model for instance, are suddenly going to be completely non-local. Or should you just try to incorporate that quantum phenomenon by, you know, some perhaps modeling, subtly modifying what the assumptions you're making about ontology, for instance, such that when we sort of project down to those set of phenomena that did have a natural explanation, we find we can still use it. So I'd argue that we should try to do that. We should try to sort of minimize, you know, quantum theory is weird, but there's no need to make it weirder than necessary, right? So we want to conserve as many possible explanations as possible. Okay, so just to finish with some references, this is a review article that you should only read if you are a glutton for punishment, because it's very long. This is sort of designed to be more readable to your average physicist on the street. And then here are some of the references that are relevant to the connection between contextuality and this overlap bound stuff. And there's a third paper, which I'm supposed to be writing instead of talking to you about now, but that's where the rest of this stuff is going to be in. Okay, so thanks. Okay.
Any questions? Comment?
Yes.
I'm amazed at your ability to summon people. Because you mentioned Matt Cusey and he walked into the room. You mentioned Rob Spick and he walked into the room. So my question is, who are you going to mention next?
Yeah. If I mention Yakir, I'm sure he's not coming. Well, that was all perfectly clear then, right?
Modulo the Mets.
Yeah, yeah. Criticism. Yes.
In the concluding slides, you had mention of alternative logics and theories of probability.
Yes.
Are there examples of that? Unstated logics.
I mean, obviously, there's a very long tradition of saying we can deal with quantum theory by some kind of quantum logic, or quantum theory is a modified probability theory, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there are two philosophers in the audience, and neither of them have made the common injection, which is like, here it says, adopt a more exotic ontology, and here are two things which refer to epistemology, right? Logic and probability theory about how you reason about the world, they're not about the way the world is. So it's true that most of those things, well, all of those things, as far as I'm concerned, do not have a realist interpretation. So quantum logic, most people who still do quantum logic think of it as an operational logic. So it's about the structure of measurement, not a statement about ontology. And similarly, most non-standard probability theorists say, well, we don't have to assign classical probabilities to everything because you can't do every measurement at the same time. So this is just the probability theory that's appropriate for some other operational structure. So really, if you want this to be a realist option, you have to say, okay, there's some fact about the ontology, right? Perhaps that fact is, you know, retrocausality or something, which means that it's inappropriate to adopt the standard arguments for why we should use classical logic and probability theory. You know, decision theory, for instance, is usually causal decision theory. So if you suddenly have a causal loop, everything's sort of out, maybe out with the bathwater kind of idea. So it could be that there's some fact about the ontology, some fact about the way the world is that mandates that the way that you should reason about it is with some non-standard logic or probability theory. In my view, probability theory more likely. But you have to pin down what that is, and then you have to give an argument for that that probability theory based on it. And that, you know, although we've got like dozens and dozens of explained quantum theory in terms of non-standard probability theory type of ideas, none of them are realist in that sense. Right? So if you want to make this move as a realist, you have to do that. And if you want to make this move as an anti-realist, then why don't you just adopt Copenhagen instead, right? So that's sort of the challenge of that sort of approach. But I think those mathematical theories are very elegant, right? So the idea that quantum theory is a non-commutative probability theory is like all over the place, right? We use that analogy all the time to like derive stuff in quantum information theory and in quantum statistical mechanics, even when we don't realize we're doing it. It's really at the core of some subjects that are very applied. So if you think that practice is a good indication of what we should be doing in foundations, if you think there should be that, you know, a sort of symbiotic relationship between the two, then that seems to be a very big clue that something like this is right. Just there isn't a realist version of it.
Excuse me, mention it again. What do you mean exactly by Copenhagen or Neo-Copenhagen? Just refusal to get involved in oncology at all?
Well, I mean,
that's a long, you know, contested
subject. It's not really necessarily a refusal to get in. I mean, some of these things have ontologies, but what I mean is, like, there are no landers, right, in the sense that I've written down here, right? There's no need for landers. You say, look, so the basic features of what I call a neo-Copenhagen interpretation in this context means two things. It means psi epistemic, so it means quantum states represent knowledge. It also means I don't think that they represent knowledge about some underlying reality. I don't accept the need to have some more fine-grained description of reality. So the conjunction of those two things is what I'm calling the neo-Copenhagen position in this context. So, you know, you'd put cubism, for instance, in that category.
So what do you see as the problem with that?
I see as the problem with that it seems highly non-explanatory, right? So if you think scientific theories should have explanations. Now, one of the reasons I'm interested in foundations is that I think that quantum theory is not going to hold forever, right? Well, eventually it's going to have to be generalized or changed in some way. And if you have a framework which has no explanations in it, then you have no principles, right? So Copenhagen-type ideas are compatible with almost every arbitrary physical theory you could write down. Right. It seems that it offers like extremely little guidance for, you know, how to think about the world if the world is something slightly different than quantum. So it seems to me that those kinds of programs, although they're consistent, and maybe the no-go theorems would push you towards that direction, seems to me that, you know, they're going nowhere in terms of greater understanding of physics.
Okay. Well, if you want to counter that, somebody might tell you, well, we came up with quantum mechanics, not me in the room, but non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and then out of that, quantum field theory,
sure.
And then string theory. So then yep. That was a fairly fruitful.
Exactly. So we've taken it quite far. All of those things are quantum theories in the standard sense, right? So it's like none of those theories said, you know, this fundamental Hilbert space structure is out. They're like, we're taking the fundamental structures, we're trying to reinterpret them in ways that are compatible with relativity, for instance, and you come up with a theory. But you didn't do any sort of damage to the basic axiomatic structure of the theory. Now, for example, people have proposed, well, what if you have a nonlinear generalization of the Schrodinger equation? What should you do then? There's a different type of generalization which really does damage to this kind of structure. And, you know, there's lots of results out there that say, oh, the structure of quantum theory is extremely fragile. If we change any one thing, suddenly all hell breaks loose and we have superluminal signaling and all this kind of stuff. But this is because we don't understand that this framework is highly constrained. Can't change one thing without changing a whole bunch of other things. If you try to generalize it, it gets into a mess, and so it's no surprise that nobody's managed to come up with a sensible generalization yet. But if you understand what are the actual explanatory principles behind your theory, then hopefully you can do a better job of that type of generalization.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Matt, again.